In 1771, a 65-year-old Benjamin Franklin sat down at the country home of the Bishop of St. Asaph in England and began writing what would become one of the most influential autobiographies ever penned. Unlike the polished memoirs of politicians or celebrities today, Franklin wrote primarily for his son and descendants, creating an intimate portrait of self-improvement that would resonate far beyond his family. This remarkable work has influenced generations of readers, including numerous historical figures. Theodore Roosevelt kept a well-worn copy during his presidency, and countless entrepreneurs have cited it as foundational to their success. What makes Franklin's story so enduring is not just his extraordinary achievements, but the relatable humanity with which he shares his journey from poor apprentice to international statesman. His practical wisdom, delivered with characteristic wit and clarity, continues to feel surprisingly modern, despite being written over two centuries ago. Benjamin Franklin's path to success began with his bold escape from a restrictive apprenticeship under his brother James in Boston. Arriving in Philadelphia at age 17 with just a few coppers in his pocket, he famously walked the streets with three puffy rolls, one under each arm, and eating the third, a scene that would become iconic in American cultural memory. His initial appearance in the city, the draggled and disheveled, stood in stark contrast to the respected figure he would become. After a brief, disappointing journey to London, where Governor Keith's promised letters of recommendation proved non-existent, Franklin returned to Philadelphia in 1726 with newfound printing expertise and an unwavering determination to establish himself independently. The turning point came when Franklin's friend Hugh Meredith proposed a partnership, with Meredith's father providing capital against Franklin's superior skill. They established their printing business just as their former employer, Keimer, was heading towards bankruptcy. Franklin's industriousness quickly distinguished him from competitors. He would wheel his paper purchases through the streets himself on a barrow, dressed plainly and avoiding taverns to demonstrate his dedication to his craft. This public display of humility and hard work became a cornerstone of his business strategy. "I took care not only to be in reality industrious and frugal," he wrote, "but to avoid all appearances to the contrary." He understood that perception was as important as reality in building a successful enterprise. This careful cultivation of reputation paid substantial dividends. When the Pennsylvania Assembly needed a printer for paper money and official documents, Franklin secured the lucrative contract through his growing network of influential friends and his reputation for reliability. His newspaper, the Pennsylvania Gazette, which he acquired from Keimer in 1729, flourished, while his competitors declined. Under Franklin's management, the Gazette became the most successful newspaper in the colonies, known for its balanced reporting and innovative use of political cartoons. Franklin's Almanac, published under the pseudonym Poor Richard, sold nearly 10,000 copies annually, an extraordinary number for the time, and became a vehicle for spreading practical wisdom through proverbs that encouraged industry and frugality. The Almanac's success stemmed from its unique blend of practical information, weather forecasts, and memorable sayings that resonated with colonial readers. What distinguished Franklin from other ambitious tradesmen was his systematic approach to business expansion. He established partnerships with former employees to open printing houses throughout the colonies, from New York to South Carolina, structuring agreements that allowed these journeymen to eventually purchase independence. This innovative arrangement typically lasted 6 years, during which Franklin provided the equipment, expertise, and one-third of the profits. "Most of them did well," he noted with satisfaction, "being enabled at the end of our term, 6 years, to purchase the types of me and go on working for themselves, by which means several families were raised." This franchise-like system not only expanded Franklin's influence, but created opportunities for others while generating steady income for himself. By 1748, This network of printing partnerships had made Franklin wealthy enough to retire from active business management at the age of 42, allowing him to pursue his scientific and civic interests. Perhaps Franklin's most ingenious creation was the Junto, a club of like-minded tradesmen and artisans who met weekly to discuss moral, political, and philosophical questions. Formed when Franklin was just 21, this club of mutual improvement operated with carefully structured rules designed to prevent the argumentative dogmatism that typically poisoned such gatherings. The club met every Friday evening, with members taking turns hunting in their homes or local taverns. Members posed questions like, "Have you met with anything in the author you last read, remarkable or suitable to be communicated to the Junto?" Or, "Do you know of any fellow citizen who has lately done a worthy action, deserving praise and imitation?" These questions were part of a formal list of 24 queries read at each meeting. The Junto's brilliance lay in its practical focus and democratic structure. Unlike aristocratic societies that excluded working men, the Junto welcomed anyone of good character, regardless of background. The founding members included a surveyor, a shoemaker, a clerk, and several printers, representing the emerging middle class of colonial Philadelphia. The only requirements were a love of reading, willingness to contribute ideas, and commitment to self-improvement. "We had one rule that forbid all direct contradiction," Franklin explained, noting that phrases like "I conceive" or "it appears to me" replaced dogmatic assertions, a practice that made conversations more pleasant and productive. Members were also required to prepare and present papers on selected topics, ranging from mathematics and science to ethics and commerce. From this modest beginning grew an extraordinary network of influence. When Franklin wanted to establish a subscription library, America's first, he leveraged the Junto's collective persuasion rather than presenting it as his personal project. "I put myself as much as I could out of sight," he wrote, finding that presenting ideas as coming from a number of friends rather than himself proved more effective. The Library Company of Philadelphia, founded in 1731, began with 50 subscribers, each contributing 40 shillings. This strategy of humble collaboration became Franklin's signature approach to community improvement, later helping him establish everything from fire companies to street cleaning services. As the Junto's influence grew, Franklin proposed each member establish similar clubs without revealing the connection to the original group. 5 or 6 such satellite clubs formed, with names like The Vine, The Union, and The Band, creating an invisible network for spreading ideas and influencing public opinion. These clubs followed the same format and rules as the original Junto, but operated independently. This web of relationships helped Franklin advance numerous civic projects while building goodwill that supported his business interests. Through the Junto network, Franklin could quietly gauge public opinion, float new ideas, and mobilize support for various initiatives. The Junto demonstrates Franklin's genius for creating social structures that aligned personal advancement with community benefit, a pattern that would define his entire career and influence American civic life for generations to come. Franklin's most ambitious personal project was his systematic attempt to achieve moral perfection. Rather than relying on religious instruction or vague aspirations, he developed a methodical program that treated virtue as a practical skill to be mastered through deliberate practice. "I conceived the bold and arduous project of arriving at moral perfection," he wrote. "I wish to live without committing any fault at any time." The foundation of this system was Franklin's list of 13 essential virtues: temperance, silence, order, resolution, frugality, industry, sincerity, justice, moderation, cleanliness, tranquility, chastity, and humility. Rather than attempting to master all simultaneously, he focused on one virtue each week, tracking his daily performance in a small book with columns for each day and rows for each virtue. Black marks indicated failures, and his goal was to keep the pages gradually clearing of spots through repeated 13-week cycles. What makes Franklin's approach remarkable is its practicality. He recognized that mere conviction of virtue's benefits wasn't enough. Contrarian habits must be broken and good ones established through consistent practice. For each virtue, he crafted a clear precept: eat not to dullness, drink not to elevation for temperance, or speak not but what may benefit others or yourself for silence. These concrete guidelines transformed abstract virtues into actionable behaviors.
Franklin's struggle with the virtue of order reveals the human dimension of his project. Despite his best efforts, he found it nearly impossible to maintain perfect organization of his papers and possessions. In truth, I found myself incorrigible with respect to order, he admitted, comparing himself to a man who, tired of grinding an axe to perfection, decided a speckled axe was good enough. This honest acknowledgement of imperfection makes his system more approachable. He aimed for progress, not perfection. Though Franklin never achieved the flawless character he sought, he credited this little artifice with the constant felicity of his life. To temperance, he attributed his long-maintained health; to industry and frugality, his early financial independence; to sincerity and justice, the trust that brought him public office. His method wasn't merely personal. He intended to write a book called The Art of Virtue, showing others the practical means of obtaining good character, though public affairs prevented its completion. This emphasis on practical techniques, rather than mere exhortation, reflects Franklin's distinctive approach to moral development. Franklin's genius for institution building transformed Philadelphia from a provincial town into America's leading city. His method followed a consistent pattern: identify a community need, gather interested citizens, develop a sustainable structure, and then step back to let the organization flourish. The present little sacrifice of your vanity will afterwards be amply repaid, he advised, noting that presenting ideas as coming from a number of friends rather than oneself proved most effective. The first such institution was America's first subscription library. Recognizing that books were scarce and expensive in the colonies, Franklin organized 50 subscribers to contribute 40 shillings each, plus 10 shillings annually. This modest beginning grew into the Library Company of Philadelphia, which still exists today. The impact was transformative. Reading became fashionable, Franklin observed, and our people, having no public amusements to divert their attention from study, became better acquainted with books, and in a few years were observed by strangers to be better instructed than people of the same rank generally are in other countries. This success inspired Franklin to apply the same model to other needs. When fire threatened wooden Philadelphia, he organized the Union Fire Company, whose members kept leather buckets and tools ready while meeting monthly to discuss fire prevention. This first volunteer fire department spawned many others, making Philadelphia so well protected that fires rarely consumed more than one or two houses. When medical care was needed, Franklin drafted the plan for Pennsylvania Hospital, cleverly structuring the enabling legislation so that public funds would only be provided after private donations were secured, a public-private partnership model still used today. Perhaps his most enduring institution was the academy that eventually became the University of Pennsylvania. Beginning with a proposal circulated among public-spirited gentlemen, Franklin secured nearly £5,000 in subscriptions and negotiated to acquire a building previously erected by followers of the evangelist George Whitefield. By positioning the academy as serving broad community interests rather than his personal vision, Franklin ensured its sustainability beyond his direct involvement. What distinguishes Franklin's approach was his focus on practical structures rather than personal glory. Unlike many founders who clung to control, Franklin created self-sustaining institutions that outlived him. His genius lay in aligning individual self-interest with community benefit, creating organizations where participation brought both personal advantage and public good. This model of civic entrepreneurship, identifying needs, gathering resources, and creating sustainable structures, remains as relevant today as it was in Franklin's Philadelphia. Despite his Quaker-dominated province's reluctance to establish formal military forces, Franklin proved remarkably effective at organizing defense when necessity demanded. During the French and Indian War, when Spain and France threatened British colonies, Franklin published a pamphlet called Plain Truth,
highlighting Pennsylvania's defenseless situation and proposing a voluntary association for defense. The response was extraordinary. Over 10,000 men armed themselves, formed companies, and began weekly training. When officers elected Franklin colonel of the regiment, he declined, recommending Mr. Lawrence instead, a characteristic move that maintained his influence without creating unnecessary enemies. Still, Franklin took his turn as a common soldier and helped secure 18 cannon from New York's governor through strategic application of Madeira wine during dinner negotiations. This pragmatic approach to defense, working within political constraints while achieving practical results, typified Franklin's leadership style. Franklin's military leadership reached its peak when Governor Morris commissioned him to defend the northwestern frontier against Indian attacks. Despite feeling unqualified, Franklin quickly raised 560 men and marched to Gnadenhut, where Indians had massacred Moravian settlers. There he demonstrated remarkable organizational skill, directing his men to build a fort with 455 feet of circumference in just 1 week, despite frequent rain. He observed that his men were happiest when working. On idle days, they became quarrelsome and irritable, an insight into human nature that informed his broader philosophy. His practical ingenuity shined in small ways that revealed his understanding of human psychology. When the chaplain complained of poor attendance at prayers, Franklin ordered the daily rum ration distributed immediately after services, resulting in perfect attendance. When scouting parties found ingeniously concealed Indian fire pits, Franklin studied and documented their construction, showing his scientific curiosity even in military matters. What's most remarkable about Franklin's military service is how it contradicts our image of him as merely a diplomatic figure. This was a man who could organize defense forces, march through frontier wilderness, and supervise fort construction, practical skills far removed from the philosophical discussions of Paris salons, where he would later shine. This versatility, moving comfortably between intellectual and practical realms, was the essence of Franklin's genius. Franklin's scientific achievements, particularly in electricity, transformed him from a successful colonial businessman into an internationally renowned figure. His journey into electrical science began almost accidentally in 1746, when he encountered Dr. Spence performing rudimentary electrical experiments in Boston. Soon after, the Philadelphia Library received a glass tube for electrical experiments from Peter Collinson of London's Royal Society, igniting Franklin's passionate investigation of this mysterious force. What distinguished Franklin's approach was his combination of experimental rigor and theoretical insight. While others treated electricity as a curiosity for parlor demonstrations, Franklin systematically investigated its properties through carefully designed experiments. His home soon became crowded with curious visitors watching his demonstrations, prompting him to train friends with similar tubes to distribute the educational burden. One friend, Ebenezer Kinnersley, began giving paid lectures using apparatus Franklin designed, spreading electrical knowledge throughout the colonies. Franklin's revolutionary insight was recognizing the sameness of lightning with electricity, a theory initially ridiculed when communicated to London's Royal Society. Undeterred by skepticism, Franklin proposed his famous kite experiment to draw lightning from clouds. When French scientists Dalibard and Delort successfully conducted similar experiments using Franklin's method, and Franklin himself flew his kite during a thunderstorm in Philadelphia, the scientific world was forced to acknowledge his breakthrough. The practical application, the lightning rod, soon protected buildings throughout Europe and America. The impact on Franklin's reputation was transformative. The Royal Society, which had initially laughed at his theories, granted him membership without the usual fees and awarded him the prestigious Copley Medal. Cambridge and Yale awarded him honorary degrees, despite his lack of formal education. European intellectuals began to wonder how such sophisticated scientific work could emerge from provincial America, paving the way for Franklin's later diplomatic success by establishing American intellectual credibility. What makes Franklin's scientific work remarkable is how he conducted it amid his numerous other activities. These weren't the achievements of a cloistered academic, but of a busy printer, civic leader, and politician who pursued science in his limited spare time. His approach combined practical utility with theoretical insight. He wasn't interested in knowledge for its own sake, but for its potential to improve human life. This pragmatic approach to science, focused on observable phenomena rather than abstract speculation, became characteristic of American scientific tradition. Franklin's transformation from tradesman to statesman began with his election to the Pennsylvania Assembly in 1751. Initially serving as clerk, he found this position advantageous, as it gave him control over printing contracts while allowing him to observe political dynamics. When later elected as a representative, he discovered his true calling. Public affairs increasingly occupied his time and energy, while his printing business was managed by his partner, David Hall. The central political conflict in Pennsylvania involved the Penn family, who owned the colony as proprietors and appointed its governors. These governors operated under restrictive instructions from the Penns, particularly regarding taxation of proprietary estates. When the assembly needed funds for frontier defense during the French and Indian War, the governor refused to approve tax bills unless proprietary lands were exempted, creating a constitutional crisis that Franklin navigated with characteristic ingenuity. Franklin's political education accelerated through his involvement with General Braddock's ill-fated expedition against the French in 1755. When Braddock's army landed in Virginia, lacking transportation, Franklin used his influence to secure 150 wagons and 259 pack horses from Pennsylvania farmers, an extraordinary logistical achievement accomplished in just 2 weeks. During preparations, Franklin cautiously warned Braddock about the danger of ambush along his march, but the general dismissed these concerns, stating that while savages might threaten raw American militia, they could make no impression on the king's regular and disciplined troops. Braddock's subsequent defeat and death proved Franklin's warning prophetic. The assembly eventually decided to petition the king against proprietary instructions and appointed Franklin as agent to England, a pivotal moment in his career. Before departing, he endured months of delay waiting for dispatches from the indecisive Lord Loudoun, whom Franklin memorably described as, like St. George on the signs, always on horseback and never rides on. This frustrating experience taught Franklin valuable lessons about military bureaucracy that would serve him well in later negotiations. Franklin's appointment as colonial agent marked his transition from local to imperial politics. Though he departed believing his mission would last only a few months, this journey began his transformation into America's premier diplomat and spokesman. The skills he had developed, patience, persuasion, networking, and strategic thinking, would soon be applied on an international stage, preparing him for his later crucial role in securing American independence. Franklin's most accessible legacy comes through the pithy maxims he published in Poor Richard's Almanac. These weren't merely clever sayings, but distilled life philosophy that Franklin himself practiced. I filled all the little spaces that occurred between the remarkable days in the calendar with proverbial sentences, he explained, chiefly such as inculcated industry and frugality as the means of procuring wealth and thereby securing virtue. The core of Franklin's philosophy centered on self-reliance and practical virtue. God helps those who help themselves, he famously wrote, emphasizing personal agency rather than passive acceptance of circumstances. His maxims promoted diligence. Early to bed and early to rise makes a man healthy, wealthy, and wise. Prudence, a penny saved is a penny earned, and moderation in all things. What made these sayings powerful wasn't their originality, Franklin freely borrowed from ancient wisdom, but their practical application to everyday colonial life. Franklin's most famous lesson came from a childhood experience he recounted in The Whistle, a letter written to Madame Brillon in 1779. As a 7-year-old, he had impulsively spent all his money on a whistle, only to discover he had paid 4 times its worth. This, however, was afterwards of use to me, he reflected, the impression continuing on my mind, so that often, when I was tempted to buy some unnecessary thing, I said to myself, "Don't give too much for the whistle." Throughout his life, Franklin observed countless people paying too much for their whistles, the ambitious sacrificing peace for advancement, the miser forfeiting comfort for wealth, the pleasure seeker trading health for momentary indulgence. This simple childhood lesson became a touchstone for evaluating life's trade-offs and maintaining perspective on what truly matters. What distinguishes Franklin's philosophy is its practical optimism. Unlike religious moralists who emphasized human depravity or philosophers focused on abstract principles, Franklin believed in achievable self-improvement through practical methods. His system wasn't about perfection, but progress, making oneself a little better each day through conscious effort. Human felicity is produced not so much by great pieces of good fortune that seldom happen, he observed, as by little advantages that occur every day. This philosophy, practical, optimistic, and focused on continuous improvement, remains Franklin's most accessible gift to posterity. In a world increasingly dominated by extremes, his middle path of moderation, his balance of ambition with contentment, and his focus on both personal advancement and public good offer a model of living that remains as relevant today as it was in 18th century America.